The death toll from U.S. Israeli genocide in Gaza nears 19,000. Palestinian fighters remain engaged in heavy fighting, inflicting heavy losses on occupation forces. Pressure mounts on the Israeli prime minister as he fails to free captives from Gaza, while three of those held are killed by the regime's own forces. And key shipping firms pause Red Sea travel as Yemen's army warns it will continue targeting Israeli-bound ships unless medicine and food is allowed into Gaza. Palestinians in Gaza wake up to another day of Israeli bloodshed as they've been facing an unending nightmare of airstrikes and shelling for 2 months now, or over 2 months, I should say. Fresh attack by Israeli warplanes on two homes in Northern Strip has claimed at least 14 lives. Those killed were transferred to a medical facility in the city of Jabalia, but many still remain under the rubble of the bombed-out buildings. Meanwhile, bodies of 8 Palestinian students have been found at a school in the Jabalia refugee camp. Those students, in addition to a number of other civilians, were killed in an execution-style murder some days ago. Israel's genocidal war on Gaza is now in its 71st day. Total death toll is nearing 19,000, mostly women and children. Medical facilities are not spared from the regime's violence. Israeli military has completely destroyed the southern part of Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says that Israeli forces are crumbling in the Gaza Strip in the face of resistance fighters. Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, says that this despite the fact that resistance is pitted against an army equipped with the most advanced weapons and fighter jets. Qassam spokesperson Abu Ubaidah says its fighters have targeted more than 100 Israeli military vehicles over the past 5 days. The spokesman also says fatalities of Israeli troopers are many times greater than what the regime is acknowledging. Hamas has turned streets into Gaza into a deadly maze for Israeli forces. The assessment's being made by Israeli experts and an Israeli commander. They say the movement has used weapons stockpile, knowledge of the terrain, and vast tunnel network to its advantage. Retired Israeli Major General Yaakov Admirer said the Israeli army has now found a good solution for Hamas's tunnel network in Gaza. Also, foreign policy advisor to the Israeli Prime Minister, Ofir Falk, says that Tel Aviv is paying a huge price with the lives of its troops. The regime has confirmed the deaths of around 110 forces in the offensive starting nearly 2 months ago. Hundreds of Israelis have held a protest in Tel Aviv demanding the regime make efforts to release captives being held by Hamas. Protesters first gather outside a military compound and then march throughout the city. They're calling for negotiations over the release of dozens of Israelis held by the Palestinian resistance group in Gaza. They also blamed Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for the killing of 3 of the captives on Friday. Trio was killed by the regime's own invading troops. Israel's incessant bombings and shelling had earlier killed some other Hamas-held captives. More than 100 Israelis remain in custody in Gaza. That after a week-long truce in late November saw Hamas swapping more than 100 captives with 240 Palestinian women and children. Yemen's armed forces say they have targeted 2 Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea.
The naval units of the Yemeni armed forces, with the help of God Almighty, carried out a military operation against 2 container ships, MSC Palladium and MSC Alania. They were heading to Israel and were targeted by 2 appropriate naval missiles.
Sari said the attack came after 2 ships refused to respond to warnings by the Yemeni Navy. A spokesman vowed all Israel-bound vessels would be targeted, but reassured all other ships passing near Yemeni territory of safe passage. Yemen says strikes are in response to Israel's deadly onslaught on Gaza. Sana'a says it will continue the attacks until Israel stops its genocide in Gaza and that needed food and medicine are allowed into the blockaded enclave. Danish shipping company Maersk said that it will pause all container ships through the Red Sea. The company added shipments will be sent on a detour around Africa until further notice. Joining us now from Rome is Mohamed Ali Araki, a journalist and political analyst, for more on the story. Hello, Mr. Araki. Welcome to the conversation here. 70-plus days in this, the atrocities we've been witnessing on the besieged Gaza Strip and also on the occupied West Bank. Your initial thoughts on where we stand today?
Yes. So thank you very much, firstly, for this opportunity to join you again. So as you all know, the war has been ongoing for over 60 days, and one of the most important powers in this war has been the Yemen Ansarullah. What they have been doing is they have changed the equation in Bab al-Mandab. So the significance of their work comes from this aspect, that they have said that if anything is to reach the occupied lands, the same has to go on for Gaza. What is very surprising is when the Ukrainian war started, we witnessed arrest warrants be issued for Putin and all the other things that they did to support the Ukrainians, who they claimed were oppressed. But we do not witness the same thing for the people in Gaza. The terrorist regime of Israel has been bombing the Gaza Strip from the beginning of the war till now. And the international world has done nothing but claim and express their concerns about what is going on. We've not seen any serious action go on by the European Union, by the Western entities. The ones who have actually done something, have actually moved forward, have actually attempted to help the axis of resistance, have been the axis of resistance. The ones who have actually done something to help them have been the Islamic Republic of Iran, have been the resistance in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen. So what I think, what I believe here is that the West has a double standard when it comes to Palestine. And what we currently witness, based on the confessions by the political leaders of the occupied lands of Palestine, is that if the terrorist regime of Israel does not win this battle, they would have signed the end of their existence. And however, we know that the victory is with the people of Palestine. They will liberate the lands, and we shall pray in Jerusalem very soon.
And Mr. Araki, why do you think that is the case, that only resistance factions are supporting the Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank, the way that they are, and we are not seeing it from more powerful figures in the Arab world? We've seen a lot of words from Arab leaders from the Islamic world, but we've seen only action from resistance in the region.
The reason to this is clearly because the axis of resistance, they are, the way that they work is that they work as humans. When they talk about human rights, they actually act based on human rights. But when we look at the West, they only help the people that it is to their benefit. The Western powers have invested in the occupied lands from the beginning of the occupation till today, so technically they will want to attempt to preserve this investment. However, the occupied land, the entity of Israel, has reached a point where preserving this investment is no longer to the benefit of the Western powers, because what they have witnessed is a unity in the axis of resistance. What we witness today, whether it be the resistance in Palestine, the resistance in Lebanon, the resistance in Yemen, the coordination that is going on between these fractions is a coordination that has not happened ever in the history. The operation that the Palestinian resistance started at the first week of October is an operation that we have no other like it in the history of the activities of the axis of resistance. Regarding the Arab world, well, they are the majority of these countries are the slaves of the United States of America. They are the slaves of the oppressive powers around the world. So technically, we cannot expect for them to step forward. However, one of the most important changes that has occurred during the recent war that we are currently going through is that different people in countries like the Emirates and Oman, they are starting to wake up. They are starting to protest in the streets, demonstrations going on. And so this is very important, because this we did not witness this in the past years. And this change that is happening currently is a very important change, and it opens the doors to many more victories to come in the coming days and the coming years.
All right, thank you, Mr. Muhammad Ali Araki, joining us out of Qom. And we should also add before we sign off that the Yemenis are not just exclusive to operations on the high seas and supported Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. They've also been sending volleys of drones and missiles targeting Israel itself. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the Israeli attack that killed the Palestinian cameraman in the Gaza Strip on Friday was deliberate. The movement says a strike on a UN school was an attempt to intimidate news staff documenting the regime's massacres in Gaza. Earlier, an Israeli strike in Khan Yunis wounded two staff members of news channel working in the area. One of them, Samer Abu Dhaka, bled to death as Israeli forces prevented medics from reaching him. Over 80 journalists have been killed by regime forces since October 7th, when it began its onslaught on Gaza. UN officials have sounded the alarm over the worsening humanitarian situation in Gaza. They say no place has been spared from Israeli airstrikes, including locations that should be protected under the law of war. UN officials say that half the population of Gaza is now starving.
UN agencies continue to sound the alarm bell over the desperate humanitarian situation in the besieged coastal territory. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned that the people of Gaza are running out of time and options. Philippe Lazzaroni warned that Gaza is very far from an adequate humanitarian response.
The people of Gaza are running out of time and options, as they face bombardment, deprivation, and disease in an ever, ever shrinking space.
He described the situation in Gaza as hell on earth, and said people in the Palestinian territory are facing the darkest chapter of its history since 1948. He described seeing people halting in aid truck and in desperation and swallowing down the food found inside where they stood in the street. Further noted that the people of Gaza are now crammed into less than one-third of their original territory near the Egyptian border, and the dire situation might spark an exodus. The city of Rafah on the Egyptian border, the only crossing where aid is entering Gaza, has seen its population explode from 280,000 to more than a million.
Rafah is the epicenter of the displacement of the Gazan. There is over 1 million people who have fled in this governorate, and most of them, as we know, have been moved more than once since the beginning of the war. Rafah has quadrupled its number of people overnight, and especially when the offensive in the south has started.
UN officials have warned that any such exodus would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and it would make a problematic Palestinian problem more difficult. It is now widely believed that the Israeli regime is deliberately targeting residential areas and the critical infrastructure in Gaza in order to make the territory unlivable for its residents. Israel has already pushed the U.S. and its other Western allies to persuade Egypt to accept Palestinian people in the Sinai Peninsula.
It seems very difficult to us that if there was a population movement outside Gaza, I think that can only mean Egypt. It would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and that would make a solution to the Palestinian problem even more difficult.
The healthcare system is collapsing. Expect public order to completely break down soon. And an even worse situation could unfold, including epidemic diseases and increased pressure for mass displacement into Egypt. I said that we are facing a severe risk of collapse of the humanitarian system.
Meanwhile, doctors in Gaza are now warning about spread of disease due to overcrowding at makeshift camps. They say the situation is particularly alarming among children, and that comes as infections have already surged among young patients due to poor sanitation. And this has raised calls for urgent action to avert a looming catastrophe.
UNRWA and many other aid organizations have already issued serious warnings about the dire conditions in Gaza. The UN Humanitarian Office also said that Gaza faces a public health disaster due to the collapse of its health system and the spread of disease. Doctors in Gaza are warning about the spread of diseases, especially among children, due to overcrowding and unhygienic conditions of makeshift camps, as well as the lack of medicine and clean water there. The lack of food, clean water, and shelter have worn down hundreds of thousands of traumatized people, and with the health system on its knees, its inevitable epidemics will rip through the territory.
We all know that the healthcare system is or has collapsed. We've got a textbook formula for epidemics and a public health disaster. This is in part, of course, because the shelters have long ago exceeded their full capacity, with people lining up for hours just to get to a toilet.
According to the data compiled by the World Health Organization, from November 29th to December 10, cases of diarrhea in children under the age of 5 jumped 66% and climbed 55% for the rest of the population in the same period. The UN agency said the numbers were inevitably incomplete due to the meltdown of all systems and services in Gaza because of the war. Doctors of the pediatric ward at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza have told reporters that the ward was overrun with children suffering extreme dehydration, causing kidney failure in some cases, while severe diarrhea was four times higher than normal.
The conditions of the war have led to the spreading of a lot of epidemics and sicknesses, the first epidemic of which has been one of acute gastroenteritis, which we have most frequent cases of in the children's ward. There are a number of patients come with cases of extreme dehydration, some of which can get to the point of kidney failure or weakening kidney function. Things are very bad.
I have four children with gastrointestinal diseases and flu. My youngest son has a cold, but we don't have any medicine. I have never felt as helpless and miserable in my life as I do now.
Since the truce between Israel and Hamas collapsed on December 1, hundreds of thousands of people have moved to makeshift shelters, abandoned buildings, schools, and tents. Many others are sleeping in the open with little access to toilets or water to bathe.
Children sleep in the tent, while some adults have no choice but to sleep on the streets. There's no food, no water. The children lack milk and diapers. The situation is dire, with no sanitary conditions or toilets.
Gaza's 2.3 million people now find themselves in a daily struggle to find enough clean water to survive. Residents are forced to take seawater for daily use, despite health risks.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remembered the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
In the limelight.
Stagflation and weak economic growth have reportedly led to a gap in living standards valued at £8,300 or well over $10,000. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, more than a decade of economic stagnation has left British households 25% poorer than their peers in such countries as France and Germany, according to the latest research, which was published recently. The study by the Resolution Foundation and the Centre for Economic Performance at the London School of Economics shows UK living standards are 3% below their peak in 2020 and are continuing to fall. The report said, were Britain to close the average income and inequality gap to its peers of Australia, Canada, France, Germany, and the Netherlands, the typical household would be 25% or £8,300 better off, with income gains of 37% for the poorest households. Researchers have called for decisive actions to increase productivity by reducing the wealth gap between Britain's cities, championing services, exports, and boosting the public investment. According to the research titled Economy 2030 Inquiry, the UK has now seen 15 years of relative decline, with productivity grown at half the rate seen across other advanced economies. Britain was catching up with more productive states like France, Germany, and the US back in 1990s and early 2000s. Economy 2030 Inquiry explains, but lagged behind in mid-2000s, with relative performance declining ever since. The study calculated that the downturn has cost the average worker in Britain £10,700 a year in lost income due to the slow pace of real wage growth, with about 9 million younger employees who have never worked in an economy with sustained average wage rises. The research proposed that government raise capital spending to 3% of GDP to close the living standards gap with European peers, and that it starts increasing its funding through domestic savings and not borrowing from abroad. The report concluded, if UK business investment had matched the average of France, Germany, and the US since 2008, our GDP would be nearly 4% higher today, boosting wages by around £1,250 a year. According to Guardian, British workers are missing out on £10,700 a year as living standards fall. Report by Resolution Foundation and LSE calls for economic strategy rethink after 15 years of relative decline. British workers are missing out on £10,700 a year after more than a decade of weak economic growth and high inequality, according to a major report warning that UK living standards are falling behind comparable rich nations. In a damning report on the economy, the Resolution Foundation and the London School of Economics Centre for Economic Performance called for an urgent rethink of economic strategy after 15 years of relative decline. It said a living standards gap worth £8,300 had opened up between typical households in Britain and their average peers in Australia, Canada, France, Germany, and the Netherlands, and blamed the toxic combination of low growth and high inequality. The result of a three-year inquiry by a group of the nation's top academics, business people, and policymakers, the study warned that a generation of younger adults was being failed in particular, with 9 million having never worked in an economy with sustained average wage rises. Poor households in Britain were now £4,300 worse off than their French and German counterparts, leaving them struggling to cope in the cost of living crisis. According to The Telegraph, Britain only rich nation where food prices are rising by more than 10%. Inflation measure remains in double digits in just three other countries, says OECD. Also, Reuters reported the British public's expectations for inflation over the medium to long term, which are closely watched by the Bank of England, rose to a five-month high in October, according to a survey published recently. Inflation expectations in 5 to 10 years' time picked up to 3.5% in October from 3.3% in September, the survey by US Bank Citi and polling from YouGov showed. While British consumer price inflation dropped sharply in October to a two-year low of 4.6%, Citi said the rise in public inflation expectations probably reflected higher petrol prices and showed that the BOE could not be complacent about price risks. Public expectations for inflation in 12-month time were stable at 4.2%, with compressed corporate margins risking a more persistent period of elevated price growth. Both fiscal and monetary policy should remain cautious, Citi economist Benjamin Nabarro wrote in a note to clients. Citi trimmed its growth forecast for Britain following tax cuts announced by Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt last month, partly because it expected the fiscal stimulus would delay the point at which the BOE began to cut interest rates.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Israel's genocidal onslaught on Gaza has been claiming hundreds of Palestinian lives every day for the past 70 days now. The U.S. keeps supporting the regime's crimes, while the United Nations and other international bodies fail to take any practical steps to stop the bloodshed in Gaza. Israel's Minister for Military Affairs has said that the war on Gaza may continue for several more months. How many more Palestinian lives have to be lost before this bloodthirsty rampage comes to a halt? We'll discuss that tonight with our guests. Writer and political analyst Ali Riz joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And we also have political economy analyst and researcher Clive Menzies joining us from the British capital, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Rizk in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. U.S. President Joe Biden has accused Israel of indiscriminate bombing of Gaza and said that Israel is starting to lose its international support. How many more innocent Palestinians have to be massacred before this support ends and international bodies step in to stop the bloodshed?
Well, I think that Biden's statements were important. It reflects the harshest criticism yet from the American president towards Israel. Of course, Biden, as you know, has been very sympathetic. He has a personal connection to Israel, as he himself has underscored time and again. So the fact that you have these statements now coming from Biden, I think, is a very, very important development, which speaks volumes about the fact that the U.S. may not be able to continue with its blind support for the Israeli side. We have the American National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, who is in the region. He held talks with the Israeli officials. I think what you are seeing right now is a countdown to the end of a certain phase in this war, not necessarily the end of the war as a whole, but the end of a phase in this war. And this is something which Sullivan himself alluded to. So what I suspect is that maybe we have a few weeks left for the intensified bombardment campaign before the situation enters into another strategy or another phase, which would still include the stated objective of annihilating the Hamas movement, but maybe not with the same intense bombardment, maybe with more targeted surgical strikes, which the Americans appear to be advocating. So we are witnessing a certain, I think, transition, but not necessarily, I think, the approaching the end of the war.
Clive Menzies in London. The Western-backed Israeli propaganda has taken a massive hit ever since people across the world started rallying in solidarity with Palestinians condemning the Israeli genocide in Gaza. In many of these rallies, demonstrators, they carried placards reading, quote, "It's not a war, it's a genocide." So people are now recognizing that this is a genocide, and they also blame the U.S. support for the genocide in Gaza. Is the rejection of this war now passing on to the U.S. as well?
I think that one needs to understand that Biden is not in power. He's following orders like most politicians. We need to differentiate between the institutions and the people. And clearly, what's been happening over the last two or three years, not just over Gaza, but over many causes of anger and distress, is that the people are getting ahead of the curve and understanding what's going on. They can see clearly the outrage of what is happening in Gaza, the indiscriminate targeting. One of the facets of this is that allegedly they're using AI to target, and we know from our experience in London, where they've trialed face recognition, how unreliable that is. But it does mean that there is no accountability. They say, well, AI chose the target, so it must be real. So I think you're right that there is a people-led revolt against what is happening, and Joe Biden is merely articulating what he can in order to try and not get ahead of the curve, but at least keep up with the curve. And this has been happening across so many aspects of what's been happening in the madness of the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, one could say it goes back to the war on terror and its beginning, but now people having, if you remember back in 2001, not many people carried phones. There wasn't the level of communication and social media that there is today. But people are increasingly turning their back on mainstream channels and actually can visibly see the outrage and the onslaught. And certainly it is a genocide. I think any normal, rational person couldn't describe it as anything else. I wouldn't even describe it as a war, because this is actually targeting civilians, as you said, women and children, as well as, you know, non-combatant males as well. So to my mind, what we're seeing is the desperation of the system to try and regain control of the narrative. And the only way to do that is to acknowledge, at least to some degree, the illegality and the outrage of what Israel is doing. And let's not forget,
okay,
this is not about people. This is not Israelis doing this. This is a political structure which is now global that is driving this. And that structure is desperately trying to hang on to the narrative, but it's failing to do so. And it's indicative of the whole system that is falling down around our ears.
Okay. Ali Risk in Beirut. Since the beginning of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza, the Israeli regime said that it is seeking to dismantle the military capabilities of the resistance groups in Gaza. However, after 70 days of the lethal and deadly bombings by the Israelis, the resistance groups are fighting back strong both inside and outside of Gaza. So that means that the Israelis have not achieved their initial military objectives. Other than murdering women and children, what have the Israelis achieved, in your opinion?
First, before answering the question, just two quick points on commenting on your guest. I think that the American president, contrary to some perceptions, does enjoy a certain leeway in decision-making. So Biden does have, you know, some freedom to act. It's not like he's controlled by some upper forces. I'm not saying that he is complete, but he does have significant leeway. But the issue is that Biden, more than most other presidents, as I said, has a personal connection to Israel. He's spoken about this time and again about the fact that you don't need to be a Jewish to be right, a Zionist, etc. And that personal connection isn't always there with other presidents. The second point, I agree with your guest when he makes this comparison between the current situation in 2001, just after the September 11 attacks. If you recall, Biden tried to portray Hamas as evil, and there was this equation equating it with ISIS, etc. This same, you know, portrayal of the other actors as evil, it's reminiscent of the Bush administration's language. But this time around, the American public and the Western publics haven't bought in to this argument. And if you notice, this talk about Hamas being the equivalent of ISIS has pretty much disappeared even in Western politicians' narrative or statements. Regarding your question about what Israel has achieved in addition to or other than killing innocent people, women and children, I think that what it has achieved is that it's further damaged Israel's global status, if you would like, further exposing Israel as an international pariah, as a racist state, which is similar or even worse than the South African apartheid regime. So I think that what Israel has done is it has done severe damage to itself, to its standing, and it's also done damage to the U.S. because of the U.S.'s blind support for the Israeli side. And I think that the United States, the decision makers, are just beginning to awaken to this fact, at least that the current right-wing government, which is described as the most right-wing fascist in Israel's history, is doing damage to the American side. And I think that's why you heard President Biden referring to the necessity of Netanyahu making some changes in the faces within his cabinet. So Israel has inflicted, as I said, or Netanyahu, I should say, has inflicted severe damage to Israeli interests themselves and to the Israeli alliance with the United States.
Right. Clive Menzies, regarding the issue of accountability, the likes of the ICC and the ICJ, they have proven insufficient in the past. Palestine's UN ambassador has also criticized the International Criminal Court for failing to prosecute Israeli officials for their crimes against Palestinians. But there has to be consequences for the war crimes and crimes against humanity that the Israelis have committed against Palestinians. So after this devastating massacre ends, how can the issue of accountability begin to take shape?
Well, that's a fairly complex question. First and foremost, the International Criminal Court, if it was in the business of holding people to account, if we look at the wars over the last 20 years, the culprits, the real culprits, haven't actually been held to account. And I don't hold out much hope for those structures to be in any way responsive to what has happened either currently or in the future. And coming back to what power presidents have, if we look at the way in which the American budget has actually been allocating huge amounts of money to Israel on an annual basis, not to mention the arms companies that are benefiting from this, it's a web of power that is driven by money. And to say that Biden has some latitude, if he had real power, he would withdraw support for Israel. But clearly he's not going to do that because that's not the way this system works. There is also, you know, the internal politics of Israel. Netanyahu, to some extent, is in the business of distracting from very real transgressions on his part. And so this is diverting attention from his own crimes in terms of embezzlement and the like. So I think in terms of accountability, essentially, our research shows that there is an overarching structure which actually controls everything. And conflict is basically one of the mechanisms by which they will achieve their agenda, which is world domination and population reduction. So in terms of accountability, we have a choice as individuals. We can either seek retribution for what is going on, or we can actually work to disempower the system by basically turning our backs on it in every way we can and actually build new structures that are self-organizing and actually fulfill human needs, human sustainability. This is the way we've lived for most of our existence. But since we've had this creation of money, it has created conflict and competition, and we're now in the death throes of that system. The economic system itself is beginning to fail, has been in a slow motion train crash for about a dozen years, well, since the global financial crisis. So this has been playing out over a long period. And those of us who've been in the business of trying to understand the way the world works have been predicting this chaos for some time. And war, I think in one of the pieces that we put out, we said, if all else fails, the war card will be played because it's a form of distraction, and it also aids the sort of concentration of power amongst the fewer and fewer people who are actually controlling the levers of power through money, because every institution relies on money, and that is the currency of death and destruction that we're seeing in Gaza. And this comes from an ideology, and this is not about Jews or Israelis. This is a cult that dates back 2,500 years, and it's been evolving. The plan has been a long time in gestation. The Russian Revolution or Bolshevik Revolution was a significant milestone, as were two world wars of the 20th century. What has happened in the 21st century is an acceleration of that agenda, and we're seeing the craziness not just in Gaza, but across a whole host of issues that is actually emerging from that. But the good news is that we will get through this, and people will turn their back on these institutions because they will understand that they are enslaved to a system of destruction and abuse that basically is not suitable for purpose in terms of human sustainability.
Okay, Ali Riz, first of all, I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond to what our guest, Mr. Menzies, said in London.
Again, about the presidential power, you know, to make this reference or to describe the American president merely as a spectator, not involved in policymaking, I think that's a bit going a bit too far. You have something which is called presidential doctrines. Each American president who comes in has a doctrine he wants to implement. Again, I'm not saying that the American presidents aren't subject to pressures, but they do have significant room for decision-making. Recall that Obama, for example, he came in, he wanted to make a deal with Iran. Israel opposed it. The Israeli lobby opposed it. Many others opposed it. But regardless, he went ahead and the deal was reached. Trump then came in. Trump withdrew from the deal. So every president comes in and has his agenda, and a lot, you know, not every item on the agenda is implemented, but some of these items are implemented.
Okay.
So, you know, there is presidential leeway, and I don't think that Biden isn't putting pressure on Israel because he can't put pressure. I think he's not putting pressure on Israel because he doesn't want to put pressure on the Israeli side. But I think that as time goes by, as we saw from his statement where he referred to indiscriminate bombing,
sure,
I think that the pressure is piling up for a change.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. Riz, now staying with you, the political bureau chief of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, he just recently rejected the Israeli claim that post-war Gaza will not be governed by the resistance group or by any Palestinian group for that matter. Haniyeh, he said that that's basically a delusion when he was reacting to the Israeli officials who disclosed the regime's plan for the future of Gaza. So walk us through those comments, please. Is the plan talked about by Israelis even viable? And what do you think should happen once this massacre ends?
Well, look, you have an Israeli plan, which is for Israel to have security control over Gaza without the Palestinian Authority being involved. And that's where the Israelis differ with the Americans. The Americans advocate for the Palestinian Authority to come and take responsibility for the Gaza Strip. So you have those two plans. Now, Hamas rejects both the Israeli plan and the American plan because both, according to Hamas, are considered to be an infringement on Palestinian sovereignty and Palestinian decision-making. But this reference to the day after, as they call it, it has exposed a significant disagreement between the Israelis and the Americans. I think that Netanyahu is being held hostage by the more far-right figures within his government, Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, who refuse to even deal with the Palestinian Authority, which is labeled as the more moderate force. The Americans, on the other hand, they believe that a two-state solution has to be reached, and that requires the Palestinian Authority to be involved. So there is quite a big gap in that regard. But it's too early to even talk about the Palestinian Authority, given, as you yourself mentioned, the military performance of Hamas seems to be very much intact. You know, the missile attacks, even members of the elite Golani unit have been either killed or injured as a result of the fighting within Gaza. So it's too early to talk about these scenarios, but again, you know, Hamas has been very firm to begin with. Osama Hamdan, the senior official in Hamas, has stated time and again that these plans are just illusions or dreams and that they're wasting their time in talking about the day after in Gaza, which would not involve Hamas playing a role or the Palestinian people deciding who will govern the Gaza Strip.
Clive Menzies, looking at this issue from a regional perspective, the resistance front in Lebanon, that's Lebanon's Hezbollah, Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement, and the armed forces of the country, resistance groups in Iraq and Syria, which have also carried out operations against Israel and even the United States positions. Just recently, Yemeni armed forces, they targeted Israeli-linked ships and vessels bound for the occupied territories. And the Yemeni army has said that such attacks will continue until the Gaza war ends. Now, when there's talk and warnings of a wider war in the region, are the Israelis in Washington not considering the repercussions of a coordinated and unified response from all resistance fronts in the region? Or do they have that in mind and they are actually edging toward that?
If I may, I'd just like to touch on the presidential point. In the early 20th century, Woodrow Wilson was voted in on a ticket of keeping out of World War I, but he was a puppet like most presidents, and he was instrumental in getting America into the war. And incidentally, the media and the power levers of power that were behind that were rewarded with the gift of Israel under the Balfour Declaration. Kennedy tried to follow his own agenda, and we know what happened to him. And so there are contradictions and seeming sort of differences, but it's mainly cosmetics and theatre. Coming back to your point about a larger regional war, that is obviously the main risk, that this turns into another massive conflagration across the region and possibly even further afield. I suspect it won't happen, not least because China and Russia are far more militarily capable than I would suggest NATO and the West. And so, you know, it's a bit like Ukraine. Ukraine was the alleged theater, but it was a proxy war being fought by NATO in Ukraine, and obviously there were many casualties that were, if you like, just the people locally on the ground. This is what's happening in Israel, that there is an agenda which isn't necessarily American or British, but it comes from the levers of power that sit above there. And one of the ways of actually trying to stem the tide of awakening that is happening across the globe in terms of the way in which we are governed, we're effectively harmed, harvested as human cattle. That realization is taking greater and greater hold on a daily basis. And so creating a much wider war would help to distract or if you like, divert that sort of awakening. But I don't think that there is the necessary instruments available in terms of technology, firepower, weaponry, men, arms, etc. I mean, if there are other agendas which go along with this in terms of the LGBTQ agenda, which has devastated morale in the American forces and the British forces. There was a recent report showing the British have 120 tanks. So if you sort of look at the overall geopolitical balance of power, I don't think a wider conflagration is feasible. It would be an act of suicide on behalf of the West to get involved in such an enterprise because they're outgunned and outmanned. But clearly it's a risk, and I'm not in the business of making predictions because we live in such crazy times, almost anything can happen. But looking at the balance of probabilities, I think sanity is likely to prevail through this. And hopefully those structures which have led us to this point of crisis will rapidly disappear because they've already lost credibility. It's only a matter of time before they lose funding and all the rest of it because people will refuse to pay their taxes and pay debts and all the other things, all the other mechanisms by which our resources are harvested for such purposes.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, writer and political analyst Ali Riss, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Thanks to political economy analyst and researcher Clive Menzies, joining us from the British capital, London. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program.